You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English, and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of the 17 lectures in the complete volume numbered 175 of Rudolf Steiner's collected works, his lectures on building stones for an understanding of the mystery of Golgotha, human life in a cosmic context, translated by Simon Blaxland DeLange. This is lecture 6. Given in Berlin on the 13th of March, 1917. We shall begin by devoting a little more time to what we have been saying about the three meetings referred to in earlier lectures. We have said that the alternating states in which man lives in the brief period of 24 hours, when he lives alternately in a sleeping or a waking state, are not what they outwardly appear to be from a physical point of view, but that in the course of these alternating states, a person has a meeting with the spiritual world. In this connection, we indicated that the ego and the astral body, which are separated from the physical and ether bodies during sleep, in that they are, as it were, breathed out into the spiritual world when one goes to sleep, and breathed in again when one wakes up, have their meeting during sleep with that world which we associate with the hierarchy of the angels, a world to which our own human soul will belong when the spirit self has developed, and where the being who is referred to in a religious context as the Holy Spirit holds sway as the highest ruling principle. We have spoken in quite some detail about this meeting in the spiritual world, which accordingly takes place for every human being every time he goes to sleep. Now we must clearly understand that as the human race has developed, there have been changes in the course of earthly evolution with regard to these processes. What actually happens when a person is asleep? I would say that from the standpoint of man's inner being, I explained this in the previous lecture. From the standpoint of his relationship to the universe, man in a certain sense imitates that rhythm of the world order, which applies to any particular place on the earth's surface, through the fact that one half of the 24-hour period is day and the other half is night. Of course, it is always day somewhere on the earth, but a human being inhabits only one place on its surface, and with respect to this one place, what has been outlined above applies. Wherever he lives, he imitates the rhythm between day and night in his own rhythm of sleeping and waking. The fact that this connection is loosened in modern life, so that man is not compelled simply to be awake during the day and to sleep at night, is associated with his freeing himself from the objective rhythms of the world in the course of evolution. And he therefore only has within him the one rhythm instead of the two rhythms, his own rhythm of sleeping and waking, and that of day and night, running in regular parallel paths. These rhythms work in a certain sense at one time for the universe, for the macrocosm, and at another time for man, for the microcosm. They are no longer in unison. In this way, man is, in a certain sense, a being who is independent of the macrocosm. Now, in olden times, in those former times when, as we know, human beings possessed a certain atavistic clairvoyance, they fitted in more closely, as regards this rhythm, with the great rhythms of the cosmic order. In former times, people's sleeping patterns were such that they were awake during the day and asleep at night, and so the whole context of a person's experience was different in those times from how it is now. Man had, in a certain sense, to be wrenched free from this parallel path with the macrocosm, in order, through this process of separation, to develop an active inner, independent life. It cannot be said that the main point associated with this was that in olden times people slept in such a way that they actually hardly saw the stars at all. They did indeed observe them, despite what scientific research claims about star worship, which is something quite different. The essential point was that people had a completely different relationship to the whole cosmic order, in that, while the sun was on the other side of the earth, and was therefore not exercising its influence directly on the part of the earth where they were living, their egos and astral bodies, which were outside their physical and ether bodies, were given over in reverence to the stars. So they did not merely perceive the physical stars, they perceived the spiritual counterpart of the physical stars. They did not actually see the physical stars with their outward eyes, but they saw what belongs spiritually to the physical stars. So we should not understand what is related of the old star worship as signifying that these people in olden times looked up at the stars and then translated what they saw into symbols, formulating all sorts of lovely images and symbols. It is very easy to say, in the sense of modern science, that in these ancient times people had very fertile imaginations. They imagined gods amidst Saturn, Sun, and Moon. Through their fantasy they translated animal forms into the signs of the zodiac. One really has to give credit to the active imaginations of the modern scientific experts who fabricated such ideas. What is, however, true is that in that state of consciousness, of the egos and astral bodies of these people in olden times, things really did appear in the way that has been described, so that they really saw and perceived such phenomena. This meant, however, that people had a direct perception of the spirit that pervades the universe. They lived with this spirit with which the universe is ensouled. We are really only properly adapted to the earth through our physical and etheric bodies. As for our ego and astral body, they are suited to the spirit that ensouls the universe in the manner just described. We may say that our ego and astral body belong to this realm of the universe, but man needs to develop himself in such a way that he can discover the innermost nature of his ego and astral body from his experiences within them. For this purpose, the outer experience that existed in former times had to disappear for a while. It had to become obscured. The consciousness of communication with the stars had to recede. It had to be dimmed, so that a man's inner being might be strengthened in such a way that at some future time he might learn to develop the inner strength to be able to find the spirit as a spirit. Just as people in former times were connected in the course of every night with the spirit of the starry world, so were they similarly connected with that same spirit in the course of every year. But in the course of the year they eventually came in contact with the higher spirit of the starry world, with what actually takes place in that world. During the night, the forms of the stars in their peacefulness exercised their influence upon them. In the course of the year, they were affected by the change associated with the passage of the sun during the year, and thereby also with the destiny of the earth in its yearly cycle, as it passes through the seasons, and especially through summer and winter. You see, although there are still certain traditions with regard to the experience that people had in olden times when they were asleep at night, there are relatively few traditions, or to be more precise, very few of which the origin is known, remaining of those still more distant times, when man's life encompassed the mysteries of the course of the year. Nevertheless, the reverberations of these experiences of the yearly cycle still persist, although they are little understood. Among the myths of the different peoples, you will constantly find those which testify that there was everywhere a knowledge of a battle of winter with summer, of summer with winter. Here, again, present-day scholars view this as symbolizing the creative imagination of people in olden times, which in our progress and sophistication we have gone so far beyond. These were, however, real experiences that people went through, experiences which played a deep and significant part in the whole cultural environment of these ancient times. There were mysteries in which considerable emphasis was placed on acquiring knowledge of the secrets of the year's course. We need to have some idea of the significance of such mysteries. They were different in really ancient times from how they were in the historical periods of ancient Greece, ancient Egypt, or ancient Greece, or even in the earliest period of Roman history. We will, therefore, consider those mysteries which faded into oblivion with the ancient cultures of Egypt, Greece, and Rome. In these mysteries, there was still an awareness of the relationship of the earth with the universe as a whole. Suitable individuals were therefore chosen and subjected to a quite particular psychic treatment in accordance with a process that would no longer be allowed today. And at a particular time, over the course of several days during winter, they were sent to certain specially prepared locations in order that they might fulfill a receptive function for what the universe, the extraterrestrial cosmos, is able to communicate to the earth at such times, when the earth can offer an adequate receptive function of this nature. In these ancient times, the decisive period for this was not precisely our modern Christmas, but was fairly close to it. But the exact time is not so important. Let us assume the time to be from the 24th and 25th of December through into the early days of January. This time is one when, because of the special position of the sun with regard to the earth, the universe conveys something to the earth that it does not at other times. It is the time when the universe speaks more intimately with the earth than at other times. This is because the sun does not display the power that it has in summer at this time, for this power has, in a certain sense, withdrawn. Now, the leaders of the old mysteries used this time, in conjunction with certain individuals who were trained for this purpose, in specially prepared locations, to make it possible for deep secrets from the cosmos which came down to the earth in the course of this intimate dialogue of the cosmos with the earth to be received by them. This can be compared today with something far more trivial, but it, nevertheless, bears comparison with it. You know that so-called wireless telegraphy depends on electric waves being set in motion, which are further transmitted without wires, and that in certain places instruments are installed called coherers, which by virtue of their particular structure offer the possibility of receiving the electric waves at the station and setting the coherers in motion. It all depends on the arrangement, or rather the particular formation of the filings, the metal filings in the coherer, which are shaken back into place when the wave has passed through it. Now, if we suppose that the mysteries of the universe, the extraterrestrial cosmos, pass through the earth at this particular time that I have indicated, a reception device will be needed. For the electric waves would merely pass by the receiving station if one did not have the particular instrument with the coherer. One would, as it were, need a coherer for what comes forth from the cosmos. The ancient Greeks used their Pythia, their priestesses, for this purpose. They were trained to do this, and through being exposed to what came down from the cosmos, they were able to communicate these mysteries of the universe. These mysteries, then, came to be interpreted by those who had, perhaps, not been able to fulfill the function of actually receiving them for some time. Nevertheless, the mysteries of the universe were still imparted. All this was, of course, carried out under the sign of the holiest mysteries, a sign of which our present age, which has lost all trace of anything sacred, has no conception. In our time, the main priority would, of course, be to interview the priests of the mysteries. Now, what was actually demanded of these priests of the mysteries? It was, in a certain sense, necessary for them to know that if they incorporated the fructifying wisdom for earthly life that was streaming down from the cosmos to their cognitive faculties, and especially their social understanding, they would, through the greater degree of cleverness that they had imbibed, be capable of establishing social regulations for the immediate future, of making the legal and other arrangements for the coming year. There were formerly times on earth when people would not have instituted social regulations or legal structures without first having sought guidance in this way from those whose task it was to receive the mysteries of the macrocosm. Later ages have preserved feeble and dubious echoes of this great wisdom in superstitious fancies. When, on New Year's Eve, people pour melted lead into water with the object of finding out about what the coming year has in store, this is the superstitious residue of that great holy task of which I have been speaking. Its aim was essentially so to fructify the spirit of human beings, that what can only spring from the cosmos might become a reality on the earth. For there was a wish that man should live on the earth in such a way that his life is not merely the result of what one can experience on the earth, but a result of what one can learn from the wider world. In the same way, it was known that during the summer, the earth cannot receive any intimate tidings from the cosmos. The summer mysteries, which had a totally different purpose, that does not concern us at present, were based upon this knowledge. Now, as I have said, ever fewer traditions have been preserved of those things that are associated with the mysteries of the cycle of the year than of everything related to the rhythm of day and night, of sleeping and waking. However, in those ancient times, when man still had a high degree of atavistic clairvoyance, which enabled him to experience in the course of the year the intimacies that flowed between the cosmic regions and the earth, human beings knew that what they experienced there had its origin in the meeting which they had, a meeting which does of course take place in every age, but at that time it was perceived, through atavistic clairvoyance, not with that spiritual world that he can experience every time he goes to sleep, but a meeting with the spiritual world in which those spiritual beings live who belong to the hierarchy that we know as the archangels. This is that same world where man will dwell in his innermost essence when his life spirit has developed during the age of Venus. And it is also where, in ancient times, Christ, the Son, was thought of as being the guiding and ruling principle. This meeting which man has with the spiritual world in the course of the year, at any point on the earth's surface, at the time when for this part of the earth it is the winter season of Christmas, can therefore also be called the meeting with the sun. Thus in the course of a year a person indeed experiences a rhythm which reflects that of the seasonal round itself, and in which he has a union with the world of the sun. S-O-N. We know, of course, that through the mystery of Golgotha, that being whom we call the Christ united himself with the course of the earth. At the time when this union took place, a direct perception of the spiritual world was, as I have just explained, obscured. We see the objective fact that the mystery of Golgotha is directly connected with the change taking place in human evolution on the earth. But we can also say that there have been times in human evolution when, through becoming aware of the earth's intimate dialogue with the macrocosm, as experienced in the old atavistic clairvoyance, human beings have entered into a relationship with Christ. This is the source of what has, with a certain justification, been put forward by a number of intelligent, learned people in recent times and students of religion, that a primal revelation has been given to the earth. So, what I have been describing did indeed come about. There was a primal revelation. And all the separate religions scattered over the earth are the decadent fragments of that primal revelation. What, however, is the position of those who have accepted the mystery of Golgotha? Their position is that they can express their innermost faith in the spiritual origin of the universe by saying that what, in ancient times, still had to be perceived by means of a dialogue of the earth with the cosmos, has now descended and has appeared in the course of the mystery of Golgotha in a human being, in the human being Jesus of Nazareth. Recognition of that being, who was formerly perceptible to human beings in the course of the year through atavistic clairvoyance, again in the Christ who dwelt in Jesus of Nazareth, is something that must be increasingly emphasized as necessary for the spiritual evolution of mankind. For in this way, one would be bringing the two elements of Christianity together, which really do need to be united, if on the one hand Christianity and on the other hand humanity are each to develop further in the right way. The fact that the legends of Christ Jesus have, through old Christian traditions, been annually included in the yearly cycle as the festivals celebrated at Christmas, Easter, and Whitsun, is connected with this, as is the further fact that, as I said in a previous lecture, the Christmas festival is celebrated on a fixed date, whereas Easter is a festival whose date is determined by the movements of heavenly bodies. The celebration of the festival of Christmas, in accordance with earthly relationships, in the very depths of winter, is associated with the meeting with Christ, with the sun, that does indeed take place then. However, Christ's nature as a being who belongs to the macrocosm, descended from the macrocosm, and is one with it, is expressed through the fact that the timing of Easter, that festival which is intended to declare that Christ belongs to the whole world, just as Christmas indicates that Christ descended to the earth, depends on when the spring equinox takes place and the positions of sun and moon. Thus it was right that what itself belongs to the seasonal round through the rhythmical presence of the human soul within it should be inserted into the yearly cycle. And because this is something with so deep a reflection in man's inner being, it is also justified that these festivals that relate to the mystery of Golgotha should continue to be celebrated in harmony with the rhythm of the wider cosmos and not be subject to the kind of alteration that has taken place in the hours of sleeping and waking in modern cities. So, here we have to do with a situation where man is not as yet so free that he may raise himself out of the objective flow of the cosmos. Every year he can be aware that even though he cannot engage directly with the cosmos through atavistic clairvoyance, something lives within him that belongs to the universal whole and comes to expression in the cycle of the year. Now, among the things which certain religious faiths have most strongly censured about spiritual science is that, through spiritual science, the Christ impulse must once again be linked to the whole cosmos. As I have often emphasized, spiritual science does not take anything away from what religious traditions have contributed to the mystery of Christ Jesus, but it adds the relationship extending from the earth to the whole cosmos which surrounds this mystery. It seeks Christ not only on the earth, it seeks him in the whole universe. Indeed, it is difficult to understand why some religious groups again and again single out especially this connection of the Christ impulse with cosmic events, for censure. For it would only be understandable if spiritual science were to take something away from the rightful traditions of Christianity. If it adds something, this should surely not be a reason for criticism. However, this is how things stand. And the reason is that there is a strong wish not to add anything to certain traditions. There is, however, a very serious background to this, something which is of considerable importance, especially for our time. I have often drawn your attention, in my first mystery play, among other places, to the fact that we are approaching the time when we are able to speak about a spiritual second coming of Christ. I do not need to expand more fully on this today, as it is a familiar subject for all our friends. However, this Christ event will not merely be an event that satisfies people's transcendental curiosity, but it will above all be an event which will place a demand on their minds for a new understanding of the Christ impulse. Certain basic sayings of Christianity, which should live throughout the world as holy impulses, at any rate amongst those who want to receive the Christ impulse, are not understood with sufficient depth. I should like to remind you of the significant and incisive words, quote, "My kingdom is not of this world," close quote. These words will take on a new meaning when Christ appears in a realm that is indeed not of this world, which is to say not of the world of the senses. For it will have to become an essential characteristic of the Christian conception of the world that it is able to relate to all other human views and attitudes with understanding, with the exception of a coarse and crude materialism. If one can see clearly that all the religions on the earth are the remnants of ancient visionary perception, it will simply be a question of taking them with the seriousness that they deserve. What can be perceived in them, and because mankind subsequently ceased to be in a position to see in a visionary way, what one finds in the various religious faiths and denominations is only of a fragmentary nature, can be recognized through Christianity. Thus, through Christianity, one can gain a deep understanding of every form of religious faith on the earth, not only of the great religions, but of every religious creed or confession. Admittedly, this is easily said. But although it is easy to say such things, it is difficult for people to see it in this way. And yet it needs to become a general conviction of people over the entire earth. For the way that Christianity has manifested itself on the earth hitherto is as a religion among other religions, one faith among other faiths. That is not the reason for its existence. Christianity was brought into being in order to spread understanding over the entire earth. Christ did not die, nor was he born for a limited circle of people, but for all human beings. There is, in a certain sense, a contradiction between the requirement that Christianity should be for all human beings and the fact that it has become a faith in its own right. But it is not intended to be a separate creed, and it can only become one if it is not understood in its full depth. Its cosmic aspect is an essential part of the full depth of its meaning. One struggles today for words to express certain truths, because they are so far removed from people that there are not the words with which to express them. It is often the case that one can only express them by way of a comparison. You will recall that I have often said that Christ can be called the Sun Spirit. From what I have been saying today about the yearly course of the sun, one can already see that there is a certain justification for calling him the Sun Spirit, S-U-N. But it is not possible to have any conception of a Sun Spirit unless one keeps the cosmic relationship of Christ in mind, unless one conceives of the mystery of Golgotha as a true Christ mystery that has significance for the whole cosmos and is an event that took place for the whole cosmos. Human beings quarrel about many things on the earth. There is much that they disagree about. They disagree about their religious faiths. They think that they are at variance with one another because of their nationalities and for many other reasons. These disagreements lead to times such as the one that we are living in now, for example. People also disagree about the mystery of Golgotha, for no Chinaman or Indian will simply accept what a European missionary says about the mystery of Golgotha. Anyone who considers things as they are will not find this surprising. But there is one thing that people have not hitherto disagreed about. It seems scarcely credible, but it is a trivial matter, and one simply has to accept it. If one considers the way that people oppose one another on the earth, one cannot help wondering if there is anything that they have not disagreed about. But there are still some things of this nature, and one example is the opinion that people have about the sun. The Japanese, the Chinese, and even the Americans and the English do not believe that one sun rises and sets for them and another one for the Germans. People still believe that there is only one sun, and indeed they still think in common terms about everything lying outside the earth. They do not have arguments about such things. They do not wage wars on their account. This can be taken as a sort of comparison. As has been said, these things can be expressed only through comparisons. When people begin to understand the connection of Christ with these phenomena that they do not quarrel about, they will not argue about Christ. And they will then behold him in the kingdom which is not of this world and is his kingdom. But there will be no unity about those matters regarding which there needs to be common ground throughout the entire earth, until people have come to recognize the cosmic significance of Christ. For we shall be able to speak to the Jews, the Japanese, the Chinese, and the Indians in the way that we speak to Europeans of a Christian persuasion. This opens up an enormously significant perspective, both for the further development of Christianity on the earth and for the further evolution of humanity on the earth. For ways must be found of engendering inner qualities and attitudes which all people are able to understand in a similar way. This will, however, be a demand of the time in which the second coming, the spiritual second coming of Christ, will take place. And from this time onward, there will need to be a deeper understanding of the words, quote, "My kingdom is not of this world," close quote. A deeper understanding of the fact that there is not only an earthly part of man's being, but a super-earthly part, which lives in the annual course of the sun. We must come to feel that in the individual human life, the soul aspect governs the bodily aspect, so that in everything that goes on out there in the ascending and descending stars, in the bright sunlight and fading twilight, a spiritual quality is living. And that just as we are part of the air through our lungs, we are part of the spiritual life of the universe through our souls. Not the abstract spirituality of a wishy-washy pantheism, but a concrete spirituality such as lives in individual beings. Thus we shall find that in inner connection with what lives in the cycle of the year, as do the breaths in a human being, there is something of a spiritual nature which belongs to the human soul, and which is indeed the human soul, and that the Christ being who passed through the mystery of Golgotha belongs to the cycle of the year in all its mysteries. We must soar upward with our imagination if we are to be able to connect what took place historically on the earth in the mystery of Golgotha with the great secrets of the world, with the mysteries of the macrocosm. But then something of immense importance will emerge from this understanding, namely a knowledge of what people need in a social sense. There is a lot of social science in our time, and many social ideals of all sorts. There is, of course, no objection to that, but all these ideas need to be able to achieve something, And this will have to happen through what will arise within man once he is able to bring a renewed spiritual impulse to the cycle of the year. For only by vividly experiencing each year the image of the mystery of Golgotha alongside the course of the year can one be inspired with what lives as a potential for social knowledge and social feeling. Let me read that sentence again. For only by vividly experiencing each year the image of the mystery of Golgotha alongside the course of the year can one be inspired with what lives as a potential for social knowledge and social feeling. What I am saying now will certainly appear highly convoluted to most people today, but it is true nonetheless. When the course of the year is experienced by humanity as a whole in such a way that it is felt to be inwardly connected with the mystery of Golgotha, this inner sensitivity to the cycle of the year and to the mystery of Golgotha will make it possible for a true social feeling to be disseminated throughout the earth. This will be the true solution, or at least the further development of what is today so foolishly, in view of what is being considered here, referred to as the social question. Through spiritual science, however, people will have to acquire a knowledge of man's connection with the universe. This will surely make it possible for them to see more in this universe than what modern materialism sees in it. It is precisely those things to which the least value is attributed that are the most important. Modern materialistic biology, indeed materialistic science in general, compares man with animals. It does, to be sure, find a slight difference. Of course, it is correct in its own terms, but what it totally disregards is man's relationship to the various directions of space. The spine of animals, and here the exceptions prove the rule, is directed out into the cosmic expanses in parallel with the earth's surface. The human spine is directed toward the earth. But for this reason, man's relationship to above and below is quite different from that of an animal. And it is this that defines him in his whole being. In the case of an animal, the spine reaches out into the infinite distances of the macrocosm. With man, it is the upper part of the head, the brain, that does so. And the human being himself becomes a part of the whole macrocosm. This has immense implications. For it determines the way that the relationship between the spiritual and bodily aspects of man's being is manifested. It means that his spiritual and bodily aspects are also related to one another in terms of above and below. I shall have more to say on this subject, but I wanted today just to mention it briefly. This above and below relates to what we may refer to as the departure of the ego and astral body during sleep. For man, with his ego and astral body, is united through his physical and etheric bodies with the earth while he is awake. During the night he is, through his ego and astral body, part of what lies above. Now we may ask, how does it work with the other pairs of opposites in the macrocosm? There is also the contrast which can, for man, be defined in terms of forward and backward, in the sense of in front and behind. Again, with regard to this dimension of space, man is related in a different way to the whole macrocosm than, for example, animals or plants. This relationship is such that this front and back orientation corresponds to the path of the sun. Moreover, this orientation corresponds to the rhythm in which man takes part in living and dying. Just as in sleeping and waking, man in a certain sense expresses the living relationship of above and below, so does he manifest the relationship between in front and behind in his living and dying. This dimension of space is oriented in accordance with the course of the sun, so that, quote, in front, close quote, signifies for man toward the east and behind toward the west. East and west form the second dimension of space, that dimension of which we are actually speaking when we say that the human soul leaves the human body, not in sleep, but in death. for the soul leaves the human body in an easterly direction. This is only still to be found in those traditions where one speaks of dying in terms of his, quote, entry to the eternal East, close quote. Such old traditional sayings will be regarded by learned people as merely symbolic, and they are perhaps even now. For example, one may say something trivial, such as this, quote, the sun rises in the east. That is a beautiful sight. So in speaking of the east, people were also referring to eternity, close quote. And yet, this corresponds to a reality, and one more closely related to the yearly path of the sun than to the course of the day. The third difference is that between the inner and the outer. Above and below, east and west, inner and outer. We live an inner life, and we live an outer life. The day after tomorrow I shall be giving a public lecture about this theme of the inner and outer life, entitled, quote, The Human Soul and the Human Body, close quote. We live an inner and outer life. For us as human beings, this theme of inner and outer is just as much a contrast as above and below, or east and west. Whereas in the course of the year, one has more to do with what I might describe as a representative picture of the whole course of life, one might say that when we speak of an inner and outer life in connection with the life and death of man, we are referring to the whole course of his life, especially in so far as it has a descending and ascending development. As you know, approximately until a certain year, man experiences an ascending development. His growth then ceases, and then after a while it regresses once more. Now it is a feature of man's life that at the beginning of his life his whole bodily organism is most connected in a natural elemental way with the spiritual world. I might say that man is constituted in a completely opposite way from when he has attained the climax of his ascending development in the middle of his life. During the first period of his life, a person grows, thrives, and develops his forces. Then he begins to embark upon a descending phase of development. This is associated with the fact that his physical forces are no longer, in themselves, growth forces, but that forces of decline or decay are also intermingled with the forces of growth. A person's inner being at that time has a similar relationship to the universe as has his bodily organism at the beginning of life, at his birth. A total reversal takes place. That is why it is at this time, in the middle of life, that a person experiences, in what is today a state of unconsciousness, a meeting with the Father Principle, with that spiritual being whom we associate with the hierarchy of the archai, with that spiritual world in which man will dwell when he has fully developed his spirit man. We may now ask, does this have any kind of connection with the universe as a whole? Is there anything in the life of the universe that is connected with the meeting with the Father in the middle of life, in a similar way that the meeting with the Spirit is connected with the rhythm of day and night, and the meeting with the sun is connected with the rhythm of the year? This question can indeed be asked. Now we need to be aware that just as is the case with the meeting with the Spirit, people are likewise out of rhythm as regards this meeting with the Father. The rhythm does not completely correspond. For people are not born at the same time, but at different times. Because of this, their lives cannot run in parallel, but they can inwardly reflect some kind of spiritual cosmic event. Do they do this? If we call to mind what appears in the little volume titled The Education of the Child from the Standpoint of Anthroposophy, and also in other writings and lecture cycles, we are aware that approximately in the first 7 years of life, a person forms his physical body, in the next 7 years his ether body, in the next 7 years his astral body, in the next 7 years, after that the sentient soul, and then the intellectual or mind soul between the ages of 28 and 35. The meeting with the Father Principle falls within this latter period. It is spread over this time, but it occurs during these years. Not that it extends over this time, but it occurs during these years. So one can say that a person is preparing for it during the ages of 28, 29, and 30. In the case of most people, the meeting takes place in the deep unconscious regions of the human soul. We might therefore suppose that there is something taking place in the universe that corresponds to this time. We should find something in the cosmos representing a cycle or a rhythm. Just as the rhythm of day and night is one of 24 hours, and the yearly cycle 365 days, so we should be able to find something similar in the cosmos, except that it would have to be more extensive. It would have a relationship to the sun, or at any rate the solar system, and there would, I would say, need to be something, some kind of orbit, on a larger scale, connected with the sun, something more extensive in the same measure that 28, 29, or 30 years are a longer period than either 24 hours or 365 days. Now, the ancients rightly regarded Saturn as the outermost planet of our solar system. It is the most distant planet. From the standpoint of materialistic astronomy, it is completely justified that Uranus and Neptune should be added, but they have a different origin. They do not belong to the solar system. So we can speak of Saturn as representing the limit of the solar system. Consider this, therefore. If Saturn is the limit of the solar system, we could say that in its orbit around the sun, it moves around the outermost limit of the solar system. So if you imagine Saturn orbiting the sun, it returns to the point from which it started, with the same relationship to the sun. Now, Saturn describes its course, as one can say today according to the Copernican system, in around 29 or so years, which corresponds to the time in question. Here then, in the orbit of Saturn, around the sun, it actually happens quite differently, but the Copernican system is not sufficiently developed to understand this. We have the set of circumstances and relationships, encompassing the totality of the solar system as manifested in the outermost path of Saturn around the sun, with which man's life path is associated, which is therefore a reflection of this path of Saturn, inasmuch as the course of a human life leads to the meeting with the Father. This too leads us out into the macrocosm. I believe I have in this way shown you that the innermost aspect of man's being can only be understood if one thinks of it in relation to the extraterrestrial world. This cosmic world is, as a spiritual phenomenon, organized into that which presents itself to us also in a visible form. But what we can actually see is only the outward manifestation of these spiritual realities. Man will be able to free himself from materialism only if he develops his knowledge to the point where it is raised beyond conceptions of purely earthly relationships, and is again able to encompass an understanding of the world, of the stars, and the sun. I have already pointed out that many things that modern book learning does not even dare dream about are connected with these matters. People today imagine that they will be able to generate living beings in the laboratory from inorganic substance. Materialism makes the most of this today. One does not need to be a materialist to believe that a living being can be made out of inorganic substance under laboratory conditions, as is confirmed by the belief of the alchemists, who were certainly not materialists, that they could make homunculus, bracket, mannequins, miniature human beings, close bracket. Today this is interpreted in a materialistic way. But the time will come when one will have the perception, which is to say inwardly feel, on approaching a person at work in the laboratory, for it will come about that living things are brought forth from non-living things under laboratory conditions, that one is compelled to say to the person who is doing this, quote, "Welcome to the star of the hour," close quote, because this will not simply be possible at any time at random, but it will depend on the positions of the stars. Whether life arises from the lifeless depends on forces that are not of the earth, but which derive from the cosmos. There is much that is associated with these mysteries. Now it is possible, and we shall speak about these things in the near future, to say a lot about these matters, regarding which St. Martin, the so-called unknown philosopher, says in various passages of his book titled On Truth and Errors, that he thanks God that they are veiled in secrecy. They cannot remain veiled in deep mystery, because human beings need them for their further development. But it is necessary that people once again develop a serious attitude to all these things, and acquire that feeling for holiness, without which one will not use this knowledge for the world in the right way. We shall speak further about these matters next time. The end of Lecture 6.